Hamrick joins us. I'm proud to call him a friend and a good one, and he is a fan of the radio station. Notwithstanding all of that, he also is a proud owner of a couple of great canines that I'll ask him about in a second, but here on the Steve Cochran podcast, nice to have you.
It's great to be with you, and it's always an honor to be on the station that I grew up listening to, WGN. First in sound, first in service, first in sports.
That was in
1961,
yeah.
60, somewhere in there. That was one of the slogans. You weren't born then, but I was.
Oh, of course I was. Now, let me talk about your history for a second, because as much as people think they know you, I don't know how much they actually know, because if I'm right about this, weren't you a baseball guy when you were a kid?
Yeah, and part of it was the radio station. I listened to a very talented announcer doing the Cubs named Jack Quinlan, and wrote to Jack because I wanted to be a baseball announcer, and I got a picture, black and white card, of him and Lou Boudreau at the WGN microphone. I heard back from him. I wrote to other announcers about my ambition to be a baseball broadcaster, never heard back, but from Jack Quinlan, who passed away way too young from an automobile accident. Yep. I did hear back from Jack. But until I saw hockey for the first time in 1960, I wanted to be a baseball announcer. And boy, once I saw hockey in Fort Wayne, it was an IHL game, and it was rough, and there was a fight with 2 seconds left in overtime, and the game ended in a tie. But it was pretty rough stuff, but it was fun, and all of a sudden it was an epiphany for me, and my whole thought pattern changed, and it was at that point that I still am a baseball fan, but I didn't want to be a broadcaster anymore. At that, I wanted to do hockey.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's another sport on the planet, I'm certainly not aware of one, where until you see it live, you really don't get how great it is.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, people in Chicago are blessed with having not only the NHL team there, but also an American Hockey League team out near O'Hare, the Wolves, and other teams that they can see nearby. Because you're right, that's one of the great benefits that an extensive minor league hockey system across North America gives, is that it's a long way for many people, such as where I grew up in North Central Indiana. It was a long way to an NHL city, but Fort Wayne was only 40 miles away, and so we could see hockey live, and that's how I got hooked. That's how a lot of people get hooked on the sport, is they see it live played by a college or a professional team or by a junior hockey team, and all of a sudden there's something about it that just latches on to you, and it never lets go.
Yeah, there's kids that play in Frostbite Falls, Minnesota, with Bullwinkle and Rocky in the stands that never get to the show, but it's not dissimilar to work their way up through the various levels of the sport and the way you and I came up in the business. You don't get to go to the NHL Network or NBC immediately, do you?
No. For me, and I'd like to know what you were paid for your first job. For me, minimum wage in 1963 as a high school senior was a buck and a quarter an hour, and it was a daytime radio station in Peru, Indiana. Peru, Circus City, USA. And this thing went off at dusk, which meant for a high school kid in the summertime, it would sign off at 8:15. And my job was to come on at 6 p.m. and read the news and play music, Montavani, Jackie Gleason, on a program called Sundown Serenade, music for when day is done. And we were to put those people to sleep at 8:15 and then turn the transmitter off and go home at a buck and a quarter an hour. And I had the Sunday morning shift, too, which was 6 a.m. There was a tape recording called it was a Catholic program, The Hour of the Crucified. And I had the shift, which included some live church broadcasts. And I would leave at 12:15 after the noon news. So that was my Sunday morning shift. And so where did you start, and what were you paying?
Yeah, it was WTKO in Ithaca, 1470 WTKO. It was actually the town I grew up in and the station I grew up listening to. And I did midnight Saturday night to 8 a.m. Sunday morning before I got the first full-time break. I was also making minimum wage, about $2 an hour probably then, and I could not get enough of it. I would do the midday show, and I'd come back. I'd come back in the afternoon. I'd go home for a bit, and I'd come back in the afternoon to get more.
Well, you just hang. I'd hang around in the control room and listen to the other guys.
Right.
And occasionally I'd have to run. At that time, it wasn't. Of course, it wasn't computers. You had a teletype that would that had to be in an insulated room, so it wasn't so noisy that it would bleed into the other rooms of the station, and it would bang out all of the information on paper. And constantly, you'd have to keep clearing the wire of paper. And I'd, you know, go out and hang out for a couple of hours in the afternoon and bring all the teletype paper into the guys to read on their newscasts or any bulletins that would come across. The bells would jingle. And
sure.
It's far different now, but it was an exciting time to be breaking into radio because the world was an exciting place just as it is now. And I'm sure there are younger people that are wanting to get into the business. And my only advice to them is don't quit because there's a lot of rejection when you first start out and there's a lot later on too. But if you really like the line of work that you've gotten into, don't quit.
No, that's what
all it takes is one person to say, okay, you're in. It just takes one.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue into what do you consider your big break? What was the break that took you to a level that led to where you are now?
I'm not sure if the name Harry Wismer rings a bell with you. He was fairly prominent in the 1950s and early 60s as a radio and television broadcaster, sportscaster. But he grew up in the Detroit area. He married one of Henry Ford's daughters.
Not bad.
And became the became the original owner of a football team that today is called the New York Jets.
Wow.
They were called the Titans back then.
Yeah, I do know that.
And they joined this fledgling league called the American Football League. Well, Harry grew up in a town called Port Huron, Michigan, which is about an hour north of Detroit. It's a border town with Sarnia, Ontario, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bridge that connects the two countries. Anyway, Harry had a brother named John, and when Harry got a football team, John decided he wanted to have a hockey team, and he got one in the International League, the same league that Fort Wayne team that I grew up watching and where I saw my first game was involved. Well, during a long period of time, I was sitting in the corner of the Fort Wayne Arena on Wednesday nights, taping games to myself because I had this great ambition to be a broadcaster. And I sent these tapes out along with letters because you had to send a letter. You didn't email anything.
Sure.
You had to put it in the mail and you had to decide because tapes were expensive. You had to decide who was worth getting a tape and who would just get a letter only.
Right.
And anyway, long story, over a period of 4 years of doing this in the summers and getting all these rejection letters, which I saved as motivation, John Wismer, Harry's brother, called me on the phone one day when I was a graduate student at Bowling Green and said, "Why don't you come up to Port Huron and we'll talk about it?" And I sat down in his office and I thought he would ask me questions about hockey and what background I had. And I sat across from this big desk in his office in Port Huron, and he said, "How much is this going to cost me?" That was his first question.
Wow. Wow.
And I thought, I came up with a number that I thought would get me thrown out of the station manager's office in central Indiana where I was working as a college kid. I said $160 a week, and he slammed his hand down on the desk and said, "That'll be fine." And I thought, great, my first negotiation, and I blew it.
Right, I could have gotten $175.
Yeah. So before I got up to leave, I said, "Can we talk about that money again?" And he laughed.
That's fantastic.
And he said, "Let's do this. If I like what I hear after 6 months, I'll give you a raise. And if I like what I hear after 12 months, I'll give you another one." And he was good to his word.
Well,
so
we were
stuck at 160, and it became 180 after 6 months. And by George, at the end of 12 months, I was a $200 a week guy. I was working 80 hours a week, but it was, as you said, in Ithaca, New York, you couldn't be at the station often enough.
Right.
And it was minor league hockey, but I was in hog heaven, and I just couldn't be there often enough. And it was the love of my life at that time until I met my bride.
You know, speaking of those days, everybody goes to Slapshot the movie. And there are some things in Slapshot the movie that are absolutely true about minor league hockey. But there had to be guys you saw that you think about occasionally from those days that never made it, that if they had, they could have been Hall of Famers or at least great stars in the game. Is there any one name that jumps to mind?
Yeah, born too young. There was a guy named Len Thornton who just turned 85 this past year, and I got to celebrate his 85th birthday belatedly with him and his family in Detroit. He was a six-time All-Star in the International League. He played for Fort Wayne. He was a perennial leading scorer in that entire league. But he was born at a time when there were only six NHL teams. He would be invited to the Montreal Canadiens camp every year by Toe Blake, the legendary coach of the Montreal Canadiens. And he would be told at the end of training camp, you had a great camp, have a good year in Fort Wayne. Every year, that's what he'd hear. So his granddaughter knew that I was a big fan of the Comets and that I grew up watching Len play. And his 85th birthday was coming up, and she got in touch with me and said, do you think there's any way you could get my dad, my grandfather, an authentic Montreal Canadiens jersey with his name on the back that we could give him for his 85th birthday? And sure enough, I was able to do it, and it had the French writing inside the neck of the jersey,
wow,
just like the Canadiens wore. And we got him tickets to the Montreal Canadiens game in Detroit in April. And I finally got to meet him after all those years. We met for lunch that afternoon in Detroit, and then he and his family went over to watch the game. And Ken Daniels, the television announcer for the Red Wings, trained the camera on him and told the whole story about how this was a guy that, had he been born earlier, would have been a Montreal Canadian.
Wow.
Had he been born later. But there he was in his Montreal Canadiens jersey watching the team that he had ambitions of playing for play against Detroit.
Well,
so that's the guy.
Sure, without a doubt. And, you know, it's a great story. It's kind of goosebumps story. But here's the thing. And as my friend, I know you don't like when I talk about you too much in too many glowing terms, but I've got to bring up one thing. I know for a fact that when you go into a city, whether it's coming back to the United Center or going to Montreal or any of the great venues, whether it's that or Columbus or Tampa, you go around and you say hi to everybody. And a lot of guys don't. Why is that important to you, to talk to the organist or to talk to the ushers or to talk to whoever you talk to? Why is that important?
Well, I don't know. Part of it is I'm old, and I've been seeing them for a number of years. And you know how it is. You make friends with people. If you darken a door often enough, you see the same people over and over, and the off-ice officials are some of the most loyal people that don't make much money, if they make any at all, in these cities. And they wear a black jacket that has NHL on it, and they come in and they perform unheralded work. I mean, there's a guy named Gene Honda that's the public address announcer there.
Yeah.
Frank Pellico that plays the organ. And Jim Cornelison that sings. He should sing in every city, that guy. They're just some wonderful people in Chicago, but you run into the same people in Detroit and in Boston. And I got to know the anthem singer, and he's not there anymore in Boston. He performed his last spring, and he'd been there since the mid-70s.
Wow.
You get the benefit of meeting all of these people that are just wonderful, salt-of-the-earth people, and so you look them up because they're people you cross paths with every time you walk into the rink. And that's part of what makes it fun. And the other part, Steve, is that you have breakfast with the Blackhawks all the time.
Right.
You know that these are some of the finest people that pick up sticks and play this game that's so rough. They're just some of the finest people that you'd ever cross paths with, and that's the thing that won me over to the sport years ago. Not so much how rough it was, how fast it was, and everything else, but the type of people that played it. And I guess that's the other thing that gets me going to morning skates and sitting next to locker room stalls with guys like DeBrinket, and hearing about how high school was going when he,
exactly,
when he was doing that. You know, and here he is. You know, you talk about needing your best players to be your best players. And together, as you and I are talking, Kane and DeBrinket and Taves have over 50% of the Blackhawks' goals this year. Three guys.
How about that?
And they're the best players, and they're playing great. And, you know, the season is checkered so far. But the good thing about it is there's an old saying that, and I'm sure Eddie Olchek would echo this, that you can't win a horse race in the first quarter mile, but you can sure lose one. Well, they haven't lost it yet because they had that good start out of the blocks with all those overtime games. So they're still in this thing. It's just that the ship has to be righted here.
Yeah, and it's a tough division, and you can't get too far behind. But you spoke of that core of the team, and we saw Brandon Sudd score again. And that was big news when he scored after opening night last year. Between Sod and DeBrinket and Kane and Taves, can a hockey team in 2018, whether it's the Blackhawks or whoever, can they score enough goals to overcome some inexperience on defense? It's going to cost you goals.
That's the question, because the D has changed, and the ability to for the forwards to play defense has changed over the last couple of years too. And, they giving up 33 shots in that 1 second period.
Amazing.
Disastrous second period against one of the best teams in hockey in Tampa Bay, mind you. But the fact that the goaltending is solid, that Crow is back, and that would be Corey Crawford, and that also they've gotten some strong performances too from the guy that they brought in Cam Ward from Carolina. He was superb in that second period. I mean, my goodness, he was overwhelmed. He reminded me of Denny Lemieux from Slapshot, who came in and remember he was twitching in the dressing room in that wonderful movie. He was just shell-shocked, but I don't know how he held up through it all, but he did. So there are some positives, but there are also some real concerns. And you have in Chicago a coach who could go into the Hall of Fame at any minute, because unlike players who have to be retired 3 years, a coach can be nominated and taken into the Hall of Fame as a builder at any time. And this guy's going in. He's the second winningest coach behind Scotty Bowman in history, and he's not going to be overtaken soon. And he has masterminded an awful lot with a talented team, and he has masterminded an awful lot with a limited roster. And his roster is limited right now, but we've seen great things happen, and we've also seen guys come up from Rockford that have been able to produce. And so Blackhawks fans can hope that the latter comes true.
There's nobody that fits a team in a town quite like Joel Quenneville, as you know, because if Ditka's the model, the mustachioed tough guy who is here to win, Quenneville is certainly in that team picture. And you and I both know he's actually a fun guy. He's a fun guy, and Ditka could be a fun guy occasionally, but that's a guy that players want to play for, and you, Doc Emmerich, know why better than most. Is it because he's a great strategist? Is it because he's a great motivator, or does he have a little bit of all the greats in him?
He's got all of that, and I think he also has that ability to make you want to go through a wall for him, and also, boy, if I don't go through a wall for him, what's going to happen?
He may put me through a wall.
You and I were on one morning back at the place with all the windows in it on the first floor.
Sure, I remember that place.
Or 19th.
Yeah, I kind of remember that place.
Yeah, and we were talking with Jonathan Taves, who was on the he was on the phone with us, and we were talking about him wearing the C and his ability to talk to the officials. And you brought up the point about how he was so good at face-offs, but maybe he could cajole the linesman because he had the ability as a captain to talk to all the officials. Mm-hmm. But also, in the event that there were any discussions, would the referee rather talk to a calm guy like Taves, or would he rather take a look over at the bench and see that guy staring across at him? Do you want to talk to me, or do you want to go over and talk to that guy? I think that's always been one of the things that's been in Joel's favor, too. People in Chicago like to see, I think in every town, they like to see a coach that's going to fight for them.
Sure.
And he's one of those guys that's going to scrap for his players, he's going to scrap for his team, and scraps for the city. And you might just as easily imagine him at the Breeders' Cup near a window with a cigar tucked in the corner of his mouth, because that's his hobby. But when it's all business at the hockey rink, I'd want to play for him, and I wouldn't want to dog it if I were in his lineup.
What kind of player was he? I mean, we've talked about it to him, and he always poo-poos it, and I got the impression, because I don't remember him, frankly, as a player very well, but that he was a grinder, and he got the most out of his minutes. Is there more to it than that?
No, that's it. I mean, In the overall scheme of hockey history, he would not consider himself, and most of us who watch would not consider him noteworthy in terms of all-time great defensemen. But he certainly earned his spot as a defenseman on the hockey team, and I was in New Jersey in my first stint there doing Devils games when he played there. He had come with the team from Colorado. He'd been with Toronto. He was an exuberant defenseman, but we did show one clip last year that I had held for a number of years back when I was collecting video and doing features as part of my work with the Flyers. He was playing for the Colorado Rockies.
Okay.
It was a game at the Odd in Buffalo.
Sure, I remember the Odd.
And in Buffalo, there was the corner where the Zamboni doors came together. And the puck went to that corner, and he and one of the Sabres went into the corner, and the doors hadn't been bolted properly. And the two of them went bursting through the doors, and the doors went wide open, and their skates went on that metal floor that is used for the rubber tires of the Zamboni
sure.
to come out. And so play immediately stopped. And so he is very gingerly trying to walk over that metal floor after he burst through the doors, chasing down a puck and also, more importantly, chasing down the saber that was going after it. No, he played with the same sort of fervor that you see him at the bench. I'm glad I know him.
Yeah, he is he's a very interesting guy. There's nobody more competitive. There's nobody that wants to win more. And frankly, I enjoy our weekly conversations more than I do talking to most, because he's just Joel Quenneville. You know, he's the definition. And to have Scotty Bowman as a consultant on the Blackhawks, boy, you talk about two. If there's a Mount Rushmore for coaches, maybe both faces are up there.
I'm not sure if you saw this. We ran just a short segment of it. I believe that either on WGN TV or on NBC Chicago, they ran the full feature. It was about 2 years ago.
Okay.
And Joel went to, I guess the best way to say it is a convalescent home.
Okay.
He took Frank Pellico.
Oh, and it's fantastic.
Jim Cornelison. And, yeah, they played a floor hockey game
exactly.
out there. And he was in charge. Well, anyway, I was unaware of this, and I was in town for at the morning skate. And he came out into the hallway because he knew that I would want my usual time just to chat about the game that night. He said, come in, you got to see this. And, of course, I practically had tears in my eyes watching it. And the look on his face, the big smile. And he said, you should have seen how much these people enjoyed it. And then he said, and there's some real competitors out on that floor. And I thought to myself, now these folks are in their 80s.
Right, but he's scouting.
And they're out playing floor hockey. They're having a great time. And the coach has already picked out who the competitors are. And they had a tie game. And I'm not sure if this found its way into the piece that was broadcast there in Chicago or not. But he said, because it was a tie game, they were going to have another face-off. And he says, okay, another face-off, sudden death. And one of the ladies that was watching from the sidelines turned to one of the technicians that was working for the camera crew and said, no, he can't say that. He can't say that. You don't say sudden death here.
I do remember that. I don't think it made the final cut, but I may have seen the director's cut as well. They had a great sense of humor.
But it was a genuine slice of him enjoying the time and the time that they gave to these folks. And then, of course, the coach and him, you should have seen some of them are real competitors.
Tremendous. Yeah, and it's look, we can go on and on about Joel, but I need to go on and on about you a little bit more. You know, you talked about getting teary. Listen, I'm more than willing to admit that there are great moments in sports that always cause me to choke up. And you and I have talked about this. I think one of the great moments in sports, and you've mentioned this many times on NBC Sportsnet, on NBC The Network, and and all the places that are blessed to have you call games. The handshake, the tradition of the handshake with the teams that have just battered each other for 60 minutes. You can go seven games in a Stanley Cup final and your entire season is over, and yet those guys will line up, shake hands, and say good game like no other sport. I mean, that always gets me. But if it's not that, give me a moment that choked up Doc Emmerich in a game you called.
It was at United Center, and this probably seems odd. I'm starting to get goosebumps about it. All right. It was at United Center, and it was the anthem. And the Hawks do a wonderful job of having service people there.
Oh, yeah.
And they had given me the names of the people that were going to be on the ice, and I saw that one of the service people was served aboard the USS Indianapolis. Now, this was the vessel that was torpedoed in World War II in the Pacific, and so many of the ironically in the movie Jaws, Robert Shaw did a remarkable soliloquy pretending that he had been one of those serving on the Indianapolis.
Remember that.
Talking about how the sharks had come for so many that had to survive in the water, and I thought to myself, here is a man who survived in the water being on the USS Indianapolis, and all these years later, he is here and in Chicago along with other service personnel, and they always have different generations. It's usually someone currently serving, someone who served maybe 20 or 30 years ago, and then someone who served far back, and he was one of them. And as Frank started the opening strains of the Star Spangled Banner, which Jim, of course, sang marvelously, all three snapped to attention. All three brought up the salute. And I thought to myself how lucky I am to be in this country. And I still had to gather myself and get a clear voice by the time the song was over to give the goaltenders.
Sure.
That strikes me as one of the more poignant moments that I can remember in broadcasting, and it had nothing to do with the hockey game.
Well said, my friend. We only got a few minutes, but I still have a few things to ask you about. I love the state of the game today. I think the NHL is in as strong a position as it's been, I don't know, since maybe when I was a kid growing up. But we both remember what it was like in 2004. 10 months, 6 days, 1,200-plus games went away. And boy, you didn't know if the NHL was ever going to come back. What do you think the state of the game is today? Do you feel good about it?
Yeah, I sure do. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we have so many of the star players now are under 25 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy that Vancouver has named Elias Pettersson that came from the Swedish League. Okay, that's way overseas. What do we care about it? Well, he was Rookie of the Year. He led the league in scoring. He was MVP. He was playoff MVP. And now he comes over, and with Vancouver, he's scoring points in every game. He's getting goals in every game. He's become a star. And he's only 19, and he's just one guy. And almost every team can point to somebody that is magnificent. To bring it to another one, and they are under 24 years of age. And last year, on opening night, the league said that almost 50% of the players on the opening night rosters were 25 or younger. And it turned out to be almost the same thing by opening night this year. So not only is the league getting younger, but many of the star players in the league are under 25. It was Sidney Crosby this past week, who is hard to imagine. He was born 8/7/87. That's how you remember how old
right.
he is. So that makes him 31 now, going on 32, who said that Connor McDavid was the best player in the league. Well, you could argue that. But when one of the arguably best players say it, you have to pay attention to it. And Connor McDavid is under 25.
Yeah, there you go.
He's way under 25. And there are guys in every town that are like that. And so that's why the league is in such good shape. And our change at NBC with our games on Wednesday and on Sunday afternoons we become much more diverse in that we're showing far more teams because there are players on each of those teams that are worth seeing by a larger audience. And we determined by televising our games on almost every night of the week for a long time that Wednesday was our big night and Sunday afternoons were good. And we have the Hawks scheduled for a lot of Wednesdays and hopefully some Sundays after football is over in the early part of next year.
It's time now for me to ask you about the Doc Emmerich webpage, specifically devoted to Doc's 153 verbs.
I don't have a webpage.
That's not yours.
I don't have social media or anything. So if anybody has one of those, it's fake.
I don't know if you even know about this, but if somebody at the biglead.com put together 153 different verbs used in hockey by the great Doc Emmerich that you can share with your friends. But let me just give you a few because you know them: angled, banked, blasted, blocked, bounced, brought, brushed, carried. Oh, let's skip to the D's: dubbed, dumped, feeds, finessed. All those are pretty standard. But I'm never happy in a hockey game until I hear you say the word skeetered. Skeetered? Is it skeetered or skittered? It's one of those things that makes me happy.
Skittered. It's like a water bug. Sometimes the puck just tips and hops like that, and it acts like a water bug, so that's one of those times that skittered comes out. Pitchforked is like Green Acres. It's a defenseman lofting the puck in like a pitchfork move. So all of them have some reason, and I don't conspire to use those words. They are just what I see, and it translates to my weird brain and comes out my mouth, which fortunately is earning me more than $1.25 an hour like I got in Peru, Indiana in 1964.
Amen to that.
And $2 like you got in Ithaca.
Yeah, oh yeah, those are big days.
I'll talk to Todd. I think he's getting you a little more than $2 now.
Let's not push him. When I mentioned on the air that I was going to be talking with you, a couple of people sent in questions, but Super Joe had my own producer here had a great question. I thought we're going to Notre Dame on New Year's Day. Some of the great outdoor venues is where you've been able to see hockey in this tremendous thing. The New Year's Day game on the NHL, I think, has really done a lot for the game, and I love it. Is there an outdoor venue, one of the great venues you'd love to call a hockey game in that hasn't happened yet?
No, this is one I've been looking forward to. When these first started and we had the one in Buffalo, my ambition was to call a game at Michigan Stadium, and that happened, and it turned out to be a fantastic game that ended in a shootout and Toronto won. And then the next ambition was to have one at Notre Dame, and that's happened. So I don't have another one on the awful word, bucket list.
Right.
Notre Dame ends it, and so until somebody else comes up with a new one, that's fascinating. Maybe Lambeau Field. There have been games played there. I just haven't broadcast them. But maybe Lambeau might be the next. I did a couple of football games for CBS there years ago, and Brett Favre actually played in one of them. But no, I haven't. I don't have a new one, but now that you ask me, maybe Lambeau would be next.
That's a great answer. Another question that came in. What is one hockey rule you would love to see changed?
The instigator rule, I would like to see it withdrawn because even though the Players Association will never allow it to happen, because that would create a roster spot for a tough guy, which I think there was a four-letter word beginning with G and ending with N that was often used in Slapshot.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I see, for example, I see somebody level one of the lesser-sized players, and then someone will go over and take him to task for that, like happened 40 years ago. And the person that goes over and takes him to task gets 2, 5, and 10. And the guy that did the dirty work at the start might get 5 at the most. And I just think that there's something in the morality play of hockey that's not right about that. But we have an automatic instigator for somebody that comes over and starts a fight. And I realize that the notion of that is noble. But I still think that when somebody does wrong, that somebody needs to come across and equal it up. It's just that we are out of the equal it up era.
Right.
And I was once told by a member of the Board of Governors, if that ever came to a vote, I would be the only one who would vote for it, and there would be 29 who would vote against it. So don't hold your breath that it's ever going to happen.
That's a great explanation, I'll tell you. And one more. Somebody said, I need a pro tip from Doc Emmerich when I'm watching an NHL game. Instead of just singularly focusing on the puck, is there another way to get the best out of the game? What part of the ice should I be watching?
I would say, the puck is what everybody's battling for, but if you lose sight of it and it's in the attack zone, watch the goaltender.
Mm-hmm.
Because he will be watching it. That's his job, is to watch it. And if you've lost track of it, watch it. I will tell you one quick story. When Patrick Kane scored his goal that none of us that are hired to broadcast games saw, we were always trained to watch the eyes of the other players on the ice, because their job is to find the puck with their eyes. And none of them saw it except for Patrick. And he eventually found it in the back of the net as he was skating near the net. He was the only one that knew it was there. The players that were on the ice didn't know. The referee didn't know. And so those of us who are trained to watch the rest of the players were baffled as well. And that's why we didn't have it, because we were watching the players and the referee, and they didn't have it either. And I sat down next to Patrick the next fall when I was in Chicago, and I said, "What did you see?" And he said, "I saw the puck go past the goaltender, but I didn't know where it was until I got near the net, and I saw it in the back of the net. I looked at the referee, wasn't doing anything, and I realized my job was to sell it." So I went to the other end of the ice, selling all the way. Jonathan Toews said, "I was on the bench, and I didn't know whether to come off and celebrate because we didn't want to get a penalty."
Right, right. And he whipped the gloves off, and he went down. And that's a fascinating sidebar to that story, because, as you know, the puck disappeared. The puck went into the witness protection program.
I don't think they found it yet, have they?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
No.
Listen, you're a good man, and I so much appreciate not just you coming on the show and on the podcast here, but you're a good friend as well. So please say hi to the lovely Joyce. But before you go, tell me how the Emmerich family doggies are doing.
I'm going to pick them up and take them up for their run right now. They get a run every day, whether they need it or not. They argue that they don't need it, but they're going to be 10 in 2 days. And older dogs need a run just like the younger ones do. So they're going to get it whether they like it or not. They're wonderful. We couldn't be without them. And God bless all the people that take care of their creatures. And I know that with Steve Dale around and with Dave Ennett to name dogs there in the studio, that we're never going to be without a friend at WGN.
That's my friend Doc Emmerich. There's nobody better. NBC, NBC Sportsnet, and a guy that'd love to shake your hand. So never be afraid to say hi to him if you see him on the street. All the best, my friend. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Take care.